Refinance activity is heating up. Are your originators ready to capture the opportunity? Join Optimal Blue experts Jared Sammy and Brennan O'Connell on October 7th at 1 p.m. Central for a live webinar, Refi Revival: Stay Ahead of the Curve with Originator Intelligence. You'll discover how to surface high-potential refinance leads from your closed loan data, reconnect with past borrowers using timely, data-driven outreach, and cut research time from 30 minutes to just one click. Register now with the link in the show notes for this episode to give your team the edge in quarter four and beyond. In case you missed it, Optimal Blue has announced the dates for its 2026 summit. Join us February 23rd to 25th at Talking Stick Resort and Conference Center in Scottsdale, Arizona, for a client-exclusive event packed with strategic insight and innovation. Attendees will gain early access to Optimal Blue's latest generative AI and automation tools, dive into expert-led sessions on pricing, compliance, and more, and experience hands-on demos of new capabilities. Plus, it's a chance to connect with capital markets pros, integration partners, and mortgage insiders, all while gaining actionable strategies to maximize profitability and sharpen your competitive edge. The Optimal Blue Summit, where proven mortgage expertise meets modern innovation to shape what's next. Early bird registration is now open at summit.optimalblue.com. Space is limited, so register today. Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for timely market analysis and expert commentary from Optimal Blue. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Vice President of Hedging and Trading Client Services at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. Hello, everybody. Welcome. Thanks for being here on this Monday. It is September 15th. As always, tons going on. So we will share everything we know with you today. We'll do a market update here in a couple minutes with James, Jeff, and Alex. I got a Fed meeting coming up this week. A lot of headlines in the news that we want to talk through. We had some inflation data last week that we'll get to, as well as some revisions and some other drama around the labor market. Before we get to that, OBMMI, 6.25-ish right now. So getting closer to that 6% number that we've all been hoping for, that we haven't seen since about this time last year. Seeing volume spike pretty hard recently. Actually had last week on Tuesday, we had the highest lock volume day we've seen since 2022. So a little important piece of data there. So again, we'll talk market, we'll talk about what's affecting rates, and then we will get to a recap of our forum, our capital markets forum. So we held our 7th capital markets forum this year. We have rebranded it after the podcast. So it is the Optimal Insights Capital Markets Forum. So we covered a lot of things from the market update to non-QM to just other just aspects of the business. We had a ton of good panels, a ton of good discussions, a lot of interesting guests and speakers. So we'll kind of cover what highlights we brought home from that event here in a couple minutes. All right, let's go check in with the team and talk about the market. All right. We have a lot to talk about today, don't we? We're going to try to cover a few things here. We're going to cover what happened last week with some of the inflation numbers. We'll cover just the general unemployment picture, which seems to change every couple of days with things like revisions and non-farm. And then, you know, obviously we have the weekly claims numbers, and then going to get into some preview of what's going on with the Fed and then a couple other interesting things in the news. So where do we start, everybody? Alex, maybe give us a little recap of what happened with CPI and PPI last week.
Yeah, I think largely just the takeaway was that they were in line with expectations. PPI was a little bit on the low side. Then CPI came in right around 2.9, 3%, depending on if you're looking at the core numbers or not, which were in line with expectations, as I said. And it really just cleared the way. It was the last hurdle to rate cuts, I think. And as we discussed last week, it would have taken a real blowout number, you know, something like 3.5 or north of that to slow down the expectation of a rate cut in September. That was the big one from last week on the data release front. Also got a jobs revision for the year March 2024 through 2025. That was, I think, the biggest shock to the equity markets throughout the week. It showed that about 50% of the new jobs roles that we saw from non-farm numbers in that time period were not actual jobs. The revision showed about over 900,000 positions downwards. So, you know, all else the same, you know, the articles I was reading, this would indicate some, you know, potentially up to like 0.5% of additional unemployment. There's downward pressures on that. But again, all else the same, it'd be about 0.5%. But with deportations and exodus from the U.S., we're actually expected to, you know, see a net decline in population this year. You know, that number is probably somewhere, maybe somewhere in the middle, call it
4.5%.
Yeah, 0.25% of additional unemployment. But still, that when we're talking about unemployment these days and we're creeping towards that 5% level, you know, this did not help by any means, just regardless of the level that it actually was.
Yeah, I saw the CBO slash their 2025 net migration forecast from 2 million to 400,000. As you said, Alex, I think a lot of people are seeing near zero or even negative
population growth. Yeah,
population growth. So, I mean, that part of the equation is non-trivial, but it's just, you know, it's going to be a while, I think, before we understand that part of the equation.
Yeah, the waters have been so muddy this year, right? You've got all these different things at play that make it difficult to really see what the labor market really looks like, including the fact that, like, the survey participation has plummeted as well, right? And a lot of these numbers rely on people actually responding to these surveys.
Yeah, the big takeaway here is I think it really paints a picture that the labor market has been in more dire straits than we thought, and it's been in more dire straits for a longer period of time than initially understood. In fact, you know, last year, potentially the unemployment rate being where we knew it to be, you know, currently. So I think it just strengthens the Trump administration's argument that we need rate cuts to prop up employment.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, the data seemed to be defying gravity there for a while based on all anecdotes that said the job market is not in good shape. Inflation is still under control, regardless of these headwinds of things like tariffs. So this all makes more sense, even if it is kind of a more dour picture. But as always, it's going to be positive for interest rates, most likely.
Yep. And it has been, I think, you know, in our world, TBA MBS has been rallying pretty heavily this past week.
Yeah, approaching that 6% number, that five handle that's been a little bit elusive this year, but we saw it in September of last year, and we're kind of weirdly in that same situation now where we're hoping we get to that, you know, 599 number to have a pretty good fall in terms of lock volume. All right, so where does that leave us this week for the Fed? So all bets are still on a quarter point, like 90% chance of a quarter point. No chance of no rate cut. And a slight chance of a half is on the table, but it's those bets have kind of shrunk, right? We're down to maybe a 5% chance of a half point cut.
Yeah. I think everyone's really dialed in their bets on a quarter point rate cut here. There were some folks entertaining the idea of a double 50 basis point cut at this meeting, but those bets seem to really be off the table. As of this morning, it was down to 3-4% of a chance. Last week it was more around 10%. So fully expect 25 basis points here.
Right. So those of you that, you know, that are watching mortgage rates, watching treasury rates, if we get that quarter point, I wouldn't expect to see much in the way of long-term interest rate movement. It's all built in to where rates are today. If we did get a weird surprise and we get a half point cut, I think you could probably expect a little bit of a downtick in longer-term rates, maybe 10, 20 basis points, which would be fun. But again, it seems pretty remote at this point, unless something happens in the next day or two. But, you know, the Fed meeting starts tomorrow, so it's unlikely that there's going to be any new information that's going to drive their decision.
And at this point, it's going to be pretty hard for Stephen Miron to be a part of those meetings, right? Even if he got pushed through today or tomorrow, I guess he's not actually in on the meetings. I mean, I think at this point, there's enough pushback and concern. It'll be a while before, if he gets confirmed. From everything I see, that we all see.
I think that's right.
All right.
Yeah, basically, you know, the this kind of slow trickle, this slow takeover of the Fed is happening. But yeah, it's likely unlikely to have an effect on the results of the meeting this week. But the Fed board will look different at the next meeting.
I mean, the Merrin confirmation process seems like a real test of that long term. There is some pushback. I think people recognize some of those ideas are maybe a little bit more radical, maybe too strong of a word, but more radical. Maybe it's not too strong of a word, more radical than what we're willing to digest. Some interesting things that came across those confirmation hearings over the past couple of weeks. And then, you know, Lisa Cook and that drama is playing out a lot slower than I'm sure Trump and Pulte would like. There's been some recent developments in that where it doesn't seem like that's going away anytime soon or going to be resolved anytime soon.
Right. Yeah. The courts are still moving on the Lisa Cook thing. And yeah, I think you're right about Merrin. Just he's a bit more aggressive, which typically the Fed has been a little bit, I don't know, conservative, boring banker type folks who end up on that board. But you've got someone who's going to be a little more, I don't know, focused on growth rather than the core tenets of you know, full employment and low inflation.
Growth and you know, the onshoring industrial policy that other members of the Trump administration are pushing, trying to bring back, you know, jobs onshore, whether it's this user fee for holding U.S. treasuries that Merrin's pushing is pretty interesting, and, you know, just weakening the dollar.
All right. So what else is going on this week? There's been a couple headlines that we thought were interesting to bring up in this discussion. One was this is kind of not really related to inflation or the Fed this week, but the administration, you know, through Donald Trump, is suggesting a change to the way that public companies announce earnings, right? It's kind of been an institution that every quarter, if you own stock in a company, you read about their earnings once a quarter. But other countries don't do it the exact same way. Some countries are going to do twice a year. Right. Some may even do once a year. I think we're advocating, or the president right now is advocating, for more of a twice a year cadence to allow the companies to focus more on internal issues, you know, managing the business, growing the business, rather than every quarter gearing up for these public announcements that have a lot of influence on how the stock performs and how the public perceives the business.
Yeah, I think you summed it up really well there, Jim. Yeah, Trump was announcing this, you know, saying, you know, some of you may have heard, you know, China, they're much more focused. You know, the management of a company is looked at on a far broader time horizon. You know, we're talking decades, if not, you know, upwards of towards a century. I think that might be a slight overstatement, but it does, you know, vastly contrast with the American model of, like you said, it's semi-performative every quarter to put out your results, make sure they're audited, make sure that all the T's are crossed, all the I's are dotted. And that, you know, is there some efficiency gain that could be, you know, brought about via, you know, moving, you know, from having to do this every 3 months to every 6 months. You know, on the one hand, I think some people are saying, oh, this is just another, you know, degradation of America's, you know, kind of world-class reporting, be a very, very major transition for global markets, I think. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, this is how the EU does things. As he pointed out, this is how China looks at things, you know, generally more so on a semi-annual basis. So it's not unheard of. And in fact, we're probably the outlier in doing it every quarter.
As Jim and I can attest for a couple of people that have been very, very, very tangentially involved in some quarterly earnings work, I'm not sure I would be against only having to do some of those things a couple times a year. So
yeah, there's definitely pros and cons. I mean, in this industry, the mortgage industry too, we all know that you're only as good as your last month, right? It feels like we're reporting every month in this industry. And then certainly, you know, having worked for a couple of large corporations, we're used to gearing up for a quarterly review. Yeah, I mean, I could see some pros and just being able to focus on the business every 6 months rather than, yeah, just kind of gearing up.
Practically, that sounds all right. But, you know, I think you definitely lose a lot of transparency there.
Yeah, that's the con.
From a practical
right?
standpoint, I think, you know, it'd be pretty easy for the SEC to amend their policies or for Congress to pass something. I think the market as a whole, like I said, this would be a very major transition for markets as a whole to, like you said, less transparency. And in addition, I think, you know, the American business model is very much more short-term focused. I think it would take a reevaluation of how we look at business in general.
All right. Anything else you wanted to cover on that?
Not, you know, not directly related to that. I did just, you know, I think this is, as he quoted, you know, China is looking at things on this longer term basis. And I think it's a continued effort by the Trump administration. I'm open to, you know, counterpoints for sure. But I think that there is a certain degree of emulation that they want to do of the Chinese model of looking at things on a longer term basis and not just quarter to quarter. You know, you see it with tariffs. They say, hey, there might be a little bit of pain this quarter, but, you know, if things go as we, you know, perceive that they will, you know, this in the long run will work out better. We've seen greater public private partnerships, especially in like the rare earth metals and semiconductor areas, with the U.S. Defense Department taking like a 50% stake in EMP materials, and I think it was a 10% stake in Intel. So just trying to bring under the roof of the government, you know, an entire supply chain in that region. So I think it's interesting that, you know, China is the number one enemy, you know, by this administration standards, but at the same time, we do seem to be emulating some of the ways that they go about business, which I just find interesting from a, you know, historical and economic context.
And we see headlines this morning too about China facing economic headwinds. You know, their debt burden remains very heavy. Their youth unemployment is super high and a drag on the economy. They're not hitting their GDP growth targets. If we can pick kind of the best pieces of maybe some of those things to emulate in the Chinese economy, sure. But it's not like China is blowing the rest of the world out of the model. I mean, the U.S. still, you know, in my view, taking all these things into account, the U.S. still remains the strongest economy in the world. We're, you know, doing much better than Europe. China faces its own struggles. You know, we're still the leading world economy. So
still a talent magnet as well.
Right. You know, so much of this rhetoric across the board does feel somewhat overblown.
Yeah, I think that's right. If you could take the good things and try to emulate them, it could be kind of refreshing to get some kind of improvement in the long-term view. I think we've always had a problem. Maybe not, we've always had the issue in this country of term limits, right? Where administration after administration tries to make changes that are just going to affect kind of the short term, right? And there's not a real focus on the long-term view because it's going to be someone else's problem in 2 to 4 to 8 years. So it could be interesting to see how this plays out. But yeah, absolutely. I think when you look at the dynamics of all of it, we are still the largest and most prosperous economy in the world. But how do we keep that going with some of the headwinds that we're seeing today with, you know, the employment situation is a problem. And that is, you know, tends to be a harbinger of being less dynamic, seeing less growth in an economy when you don't have people even changing jobs because there's a bad job market, right? And we're facing that right now. And that's going to be a problem for the administration for the next couple of years, and certainly a puzzle for the Fed to try to figure out here in the medium term. All right, good stuff. Maybe we end it with a little hot take on, again, news this morning coming out of the trade discussions between the U.S. and China. Bessent, anyway, is saying that a deal has been made, or a framework for a deal, for TikTok to be acquired, which is pretty huge news, pretty big deal. And the news of who buys them and what the terms are should be out within the week, says Scott Bessent. So I don't know. We were talking about this before we started recording. What do you all think? Where do you think TikTok ends up here in the next few months? James had a hot, what was your prediction there, James Cahill?
I think it's got to end up with one of the social media companies already. I would put my money on Meta. I know that Zuckerberg had said that he had missed out with Instagram. He had missed out with Snapchat. He wasn't missing out with TikTok. So he had been trying to put people on Instagram Reels and all that sort of development. So if he has the opportunity to buy this, I think that is right up his alley.
Makes logical sense. What do you think, Jeff McCarty?
I don't have a good guess, but I know Howard Lutnick is going to be heavily involved somehow. And we'll.
Good point. We'll see how that pans out. And Alex Hebner?
Oh, I think we already knew this, but I know Steve Mnuchin will also have his name on the deal somewhere. He was the original architect, I think, of this deal back, you know, a year and a half ago. You know, I won't get on my soapbox about TikTok, but I hope it just stays with the Chinese company. I hope it gets banned, man. It just rots your brain.
All right. It does rot brains. I've witnessed it myself. Yeah, I think I'll go with something, I don't know, thinking about it logically the way James is maybe something like Google, which is a company that I still don't totally understand how they make money, but I feel like the world may be passing them by and maybe they wanted to step up and get into the game, the social media game a little heavier than just, you know, the search engine advertising. So, but yeah, I think it's got to be a company with very deep pockets and the right architecture and infrastructure to be able to build on something that has become a, you know, worldwide phenomenon. Good discussion today, guys. Appreciate the time. Keep your eyes peeled for the Fed announcement on Wednesday. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. This should be a fun little segment. So we had our Optimal Insights Capital Markets Forum last week in Nashville, Tennessee. Super fun event. It was just a jam-packed day. We started at like 8 and went till after 5 this time around, which I think was great. Just people, you know, had a lot of information to share and it was super engaging. And we just got a lot of information, you know, a lot of collaboration between all of our guests and our speakers and just a really good mood, I thought, with, you know, I think the market being weirdly similar to what it was last September, give or take, you know, some economic issues that we're having that we mentioned in the previous segment. But anyway, really good event. Thanks for everybody who was there. We will definitely do it again next year. But we wanted to share just some of the highlights with you all today. And we all hosted panels at some level or hosted sessions. And so I was just going to go through and ask all three of you what your highlights were from your sessions that you think would be good to share with our listeners, but also just highlight of the event. And there were a lot of them that went all the way till the wee hours of the evening, even though I missed a little bit of that. There may have been a celebrity appearance or two even, which has been known to happen down there on Broadway. Anyhow, maybe we'll start with Vimy. Vimy hosted the MSR session, which is always something that we do at these events. We have some great broker partners that actually live here in Denver that sit on a panel, and they just talk about what's going on in the MSR market. And I think it's a cool session to have and a cool one to talk about on this podcast because MSR values are so important to mortgage pricing, you know, and many of us on this that listen to this podcast are mortgage people, but we don't always understand exactly where these prices and rates come from. But MSR being one of the biggest components, right? That value of the servicing asset that trades on not a super transparent market, but I think that session that you hosted helped create a little bit of transparency for me and a lot of our guests. But yeah, what were some of the highlights you took away, Vimy?
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that, Jim, that you found it useful, because that was really the hope of the session, was that to help everyone in the audience understand how critical understanding MSR pricing is, because it's not just related to those that have an MSR portfolio, but having an accurate value is really important all the way from the beginning of the loan life cycle, given that the MSR price is going to go on the rate sheet, and then how you're marking the loans to market and determining your best execution and how to sell the loans. I mean, that MSR value is such a critical piece of that. So it was really helpful to have four different perspectives join our panel. Well, we had two brokers, like you mentioned, Jim. We had a buyer and we had a seller. So really interesting feedback from across the panel. And I would say that some of the key points are that supply is still trailing demand. We've seen that be the case for quite a while now, actually. And so MSR values are still incredibly high. They're so high that many of us are kind of questioning what are the values that the models are producing. Because right now, just given the rate environment, prepays are generally pretty low. And there's still a lot of value that's coming from float. And so it was interesting to hear from the modeler's perspective how they're treating that, because of course there's the fair value of the asset that we have to consider, but then there's the market value. And so if the market value is really indicating that people can sell servicing for really high multiples, how do you scale that back for fair value and how do you defend that, right?
Yeah, I think I really enjoyed the candor in that session, I think, where there was discussion about, you know, kind of putting artificial caps on values and how some people, some lenders in the industry or servicers are frustrated with some of the outlandish multiples that they're seeing. But I think, you know, the general maybe consensus of the group was get over it. Like it's worth that much to somebody because someone's willing to buy it. So you just have to either chase that and compete with that, or you're not going to win those kind of deals, because there's some of the largest servicers and lenders in the industry are putting crazy 7-8 multiples on loans. And if you're artificially capping, you're just kind of arbitrarily missing out.
Absolutely. Yeah. You don't want to miss that mark for sure.
I was talking to some folks after that session. They kind of have a retained, you know, mix of retain release strategy. And they're just talking about, there's no way I can chase these multiples to try to retain more. You know, I have my recapture refi machine is fine, but it's not like great. Like some of these, you know, bigger corporations that really, you know, focus on refining their existing book. And it's going to take me, you know, a while to build up my servicing in a way where I can do bulk deals too. So I'm just going to, you know, let these other people value the servicing crazy high, and I'm going to sell it to them and take advantage of that bid.
The cash up front, right? I mean, that's the thing, is the economies of scale. Not everybody has that. Most don't. So you see these, you know, you start seeing these mega deals get put together like Rocket and Mr. Cooper. And it's kind of no wonder that they can put these super high multiples on these loans. And then you intertwine that with their, as you said, the recapture machine, just the ability to take those loans then. And whenever rates dip a little bit, or as soon as that borrower starts searching for a home online, they get triggered to go then talk to that borrower about that next loan. Right. And someone like Rocket, especially, who has all this technology involved, they can boast that ability to recapture loans very easily, and then thus pay extra one or two or 2.5 multiple on that. And then if I'm a mid-sized independent mortgage banker, I'd be crazy not to just sell them that loan right now, because otherwise I have to try to match that multiple to retain it. And then I have to count on my own ability to do that refinance down the road.
Yeah. And to that point, that was actually, there was 100% consensus across all the panelists that we will absolutely see more M&A in the industry. And so it'll continue to exacerbate the situation that you guys just described. And then you had also mentioned, Jim, the point about technology. So, of course, we are all in on AI at Optimal Blue. And I had to ask the panelists how they thought AI would impact the servicing industry specifically. And not surprisingly, of course, the first comment is that AI will reduce the standard average servicing costs. And actually, one panelist even commented that there are rumors of headcount already being cut at certain sub-servicers, just because a lot of that sort of repetitive data or the outreach to borrowers can now be done by AI.
Mm-hmm. Makes total sense. I mean, it's one of those very kind of cut and dry customer service type of roles, right? There's only a certain amount of questions that get asked and only a certain amount of correct responses. So it's the sort of thing that's, I think, been offshored for a very long time. It also seems ripe for something like AI to just step in, for a chatbot, you know, a large language model, just to take over that whole, at least the initial pieces of a phone call from a borrower, or initial steps in the collection process, or whatever that looks like, right?
Yep. And it'll be interesting to see if those models are programmed to be empathetic to borrowers, right? Like, I missed my payment. Can you please waive this late fee for me? I'm certain that will end up being the case.
I don't know if you saw, there was just a big study about using AI as interviewers for initial job interviews. And the folks applying for jobs rated the AI interviewers much higher. So it feels like something, you know, would be a similar type application here in the mortgage servicing world. So maybe there is.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Higher. Yeah, I guess you tell the bot to be very patient and very empathetic, and it's likely going to have more, I don't know, more patience and more style than the human.
It's probably good at kind of parroting back what you've said and asking for you to expound upon it. So, mm-hmm. Right, like it sounds like it's listening to you really deeply.
True. People like to be listened to, and that's going to give you higher scores on a customer service survey. I'll come back in a minute here to get kind of your, I don't know, maybe social highlights of the event, but anything else just technically or from some of the sessions that you hosted or sat and witnessed?
Yeah, actually, one of the sessions that I really enjoyed was our broker-dealer panel that is always a part of our forums. And one thing that really stood out to me that I thought would be really interesting to share with our audience, because I assume that we've got not just finance subscribers for a podcast. We all have family and friends who are trying to support us as well. And I'm sure you guys can relate, but I do often have family and friends approach me, even just last week, asking, oh, is now the time for me? Is now the time for me? Is the Fed, it looks like the Fed's cutting rates. And I think that there is such a lesson to share that mortgage rates don't track Fed rates by 1-to-1, right? And so just because we generally are going to see Fed rate cuts, it doesn't mean we're going to see the same decrease in mortgage rates. And I think that's important to highlight to many people. And it seems like a lot of the dealers were mentioning that in order to really see some substantial mortgage rate cuts, we really have to see banks stepping back in to buy MBS or Fannie and Freddie buying. There was comments about in the Ginnie space particularly that we would need to see Asia, who's generally been a very big buyer in the Ginnie space, there would really need to be a concerted effort from there.
Good call. Yeah, we mentioned it on the market update a few minutes ago that, yeah, if the Fed does cut a quarter point this week, it's unlikely you're going to see much movement in mortgage rates or treasury rates. But if we get that half point surprise, which is unlikely, but you know, then we might get a little bit of a dip. But yes, there's very little correlation, at least immediately, between a 30-year and the overnight rate for the Fed. And to your point, Vimy, it came up in several sessions, just the spread that mortgages have over other types of assets, right? The mortgage rate is always however many basis points above a treasury or whatever kind of alternative investment might be out there. And that came up in your session too, James, right? When we were talking with Kevin Jackson from Wells Fargo Securities, we basically asked, what is it going to take? Who are the buyers of MBS right now? And how can we shrink that spread so that treasury rates don't need to plummet a point for mortgage rates to get down into the, you know, into the low fives?
Yeah, that's right. Jim, you and I were interviewing with Kevin Jackson from Wells Fargo. We were asking, it was like, okay, so over time, like there was this huge market here. Fannie and Freddie were really the buyers back in 2008. You know, the bubble pops, it becomes quantitative easing, it comes to the federal government. As they've stepped back, they were hoping the banks would kind of step back in, but it hasn't necessarily happened yet. So there's been a lot of money managers, money markets have been buying this, but they just don't have the same appetite. So the hope is that as we kind of go on here, the banks will continue to step back, come on in. But even as we see the Fed lower rates over the next few months here, the demand isn't necessarily there. So the rates may stay higher in order to actually get these mortgages out the door and into some sort of buyer. So it's an interesting kind of position it's put us in. I thought another good point that he kind of touched on was we're talking about how some of the data that's been coming over the past month or so can look pretty frightening, right? It's a little daunting to look at that jobs revision. But he was pointing like, you know, no, the economy is in a pretty good place. You know, that unemployment number, even with this, is not too high. Inflation, we'd all like to get it back, you know, tapped down, but it's not going crazy. And maybe with that high, like slightly higher unemployment, it will actually cool it off. We do have room to cut rates to see some energy come back into the economy. And from there, we should, you know, might actually springboard back.
Yeah, both really good points. I think Kevin has a good way of just looking at things in a, kind of a worldview. He's a world traveler. He spends time with banks across the world, including Asia and the U.S., and kind of has this good, macro view on the whole world economy. And there is something to be said about the U.S. economy, again, being the largest and strongest in the world and leading by example that way. And yeah, like just these recent numbers that have come out don't necessarily mean that we've been looking at the picture completely wrong, right? Even if we do feel like we've been a little bit off on some of the jobs numbers. His take on rates, you know, it's obviously we talk about it a lot on this podcast, the demand, like we were all pretty hooked on the Fed buying mortgage bonds for the past, you know, 15 plus years. So it's who is the next buyer of mortgage bonds? That was kind of his point, is there's no clear leader in that realm. We kind of have to depend on other countries to come in and buy those bonds. American banks are buying some to get some yield, but there's a lot of competition there with things like corporates and treasuries. So what's going to make that spread smaller? And there's, you know, some extreme measures like getting the GSEs to come back in, as you said. You know, the GSEs pre Great Financial Crisis actually used to have a portfolio of mortgages, and they would buy and sell to kind of keep that spread tight or predictable. Right now, it's a free market basically in mortgages, and that has led to rates being a bit higher than they have been historically compared to other assets like U.S. Treasuries.
Yeah, and we spoke on that, and as well as are the GSEs, you know, going to come out of conservatorship? And if they do, are they more likely to start purchasing? And I thought that was an interesting take, just that, yeah, that might make them more likely to purchase, that might make them more likely to step in. But once they step away from the government, if they don't at least have that implicit guarantee, where is the G fee coming from, which is where they get their money to purchase these assets? So, you know, it's definitely an interesting time to be watching those.
Yeah, the dynamic is so much different now than it was 20 years ago. And the 20 years ago, that it was proven that the model didn't work quite right. Hence the reason they're in conservatorship in the first place. All right. How about Jeff? Jeff hosted the investor and GSE panel. Speaking of the GSEs, we had Freddie and a couple of our investor partners there. How'd that panel go?
Yeah, really good. I mean, we had some of the largest servicers in the country up there, as well as Freddie, as you said. Good insight. Big theme for the day across all sessions was how non-QM and ARM production is really starting to grow. We talked about the liquidity. We talked about different ways to hedge. But just, you know, the general theme was, again, you know, that both those markets are coming back. So how do we kind of re-educate ourselves on how to produce those? Who's buying them? So that was kind of interesting across the board. I don't know if there's any anybody has any specific takeaways from those conversations, other than, you know, people are feeling better about both of those markets.
I think with respect to ARMs, it was interesting to hear someone comment about how originators should really be actually trying to push borrowers into ARMs. I mean, right now, I think the 5-1 ARM is sitting about half a point below conforming 30-year. So, and presumably with the curve steepening, that delta is just going to increase.
Yeah, well said. That is a good point. You know, it's probably maybe even underutilized at this point because there is a decent enough spread where a lot of these borrowers are not going to be, you know, good chance they're not going to be in that house, or, you know, rates are going to be low enough they can refi in 5 or 7 years.
And it'll be interesting to see if the agencies try to offer first-time home buyers some type of ARM product as well, since that has been a big focus of the GSEs.
Yeah, that's a good segue into my main takeaway from the investor panel that I hosted, was just thinking about, you know, what are the GSEs going to push? You know, where does affordability come into play? As we remember over the past couple of years in the previous administration, you know, we had a big affordability push, whether it was for low-income borrowers or by, you know, effectively subsidizing purchases with an increase in, you know, non-owner LLPAs. And one of the good observations was that, you know, with this new administration, obviously they are going to do things differently. You know, they may be focusing on what they call affordability, but they may go about it in completely different ways. And so I think that was more of just like, expect to see changes and how home affordability is addressed. Don't know exactly what that is, but I would expect in the coming months, we'll see some changes from the GSEs in how affordability is addressed.
Yeah, good point. There was a lot of talk about it during the campaigning, on both candidates. And thus far, I mean, Bill Pulte, I feel like he's been highlighted more so for the rhetoric about the Fed versus plans that are almost certainly being made behind the scenes on what comes of affordable housing, because that's really the FHFA's stated mission, right?
Yeah. So again, no specifics on what that might look like, but just more of a teaser that we should expect some things. And yeah, we really haven't seen much so far over the past, you know, 8 or 9 months with this administration. So how will that play out?
Yeah, good point. That's exciting. I think, you know, if they take an aggressive stance on this, as they have in some other areas, we could see something interesting that might, and something kind of stateside, you know, that might bolster home building or real estate in general. I mean, it's going to be exciting for our industry almost without a doubt. All right. Let's see. Why don't we talk about, I mean, for me socially and just, you know, general highlights of the event. I just thought that this might be a little obvious, but our party that we had that evening, right? So we went till about 5:15, and then everybody, you know, went back and got their cowboy boots and their jeans on, and we met at Old Red, which is Blake Shelton's bar there on Broadway, and had a really nice party on their rooftop. Good event, really good food in that town, a couple of drinks, and just, again, good conversation, good feedback from what had happened during the day. So that would be my highlight. What do you think, Vimy? What was your highlight of the whole the whole week?
Well, of course, seeing clients and industry partners was terrific, but it might have been a little overshadowed by a surprise appearance by Ludacris.
Yeah.
Very unexpected. Post the party that you were referring to, Jim, some of us went to a different place across the street, and it was actually Jimmy Aldean's bar, who is a very famous country singer. So you would not.
Jason Aldean.
Sorry, yes, sorry, Jason Aldean. Clearly not a country music girl. and so very surprised to see Ludacris show up, and he was there to celebrate his birthday.
Yeah, that was, I just missed that. I was in my hotel room helping my oldest daughter out with algebra homework. And yeah, next morning I come to find out on LinkedIn that there's a selfie going around of Luda and several of our coworkers and guests on stage. That was that is pretty cool. That's one of those towns where I think that can just happen wherever people show up at these bars on a weeknight and perform. That's super exciting. That's pretty funny.
Well, Jim, if you were going to miss out on Ludacris, helping your daughter with her algebra homework is a really good reason to.
Yes, I'm not crying too hard about it.
It's very wholesome.
Yeah. Yes.
I thought Ludacris was potentially a new client. I thought it was Luda Mortgage that we were trying to talk to. I didn't realize he was just there by accident. That's incredible.
You never know when you're hanging out with Optimal Blue what might happen.
Yeah, exactly. That's all, it was still Aaron Wester's line that she posted on LinkedIn, that the chances of seeing Ludacris at an Optimal Blue event are low, but they're not zero. So
yeah, it did happen.
Yep.
Up close and personal, it looks like. That's very cool. How about you, Jeffrey? Is it hard to top?
I missed it by 5 minutes, so very disappointed. But, I think my general theme is this is a complicated industry. There's a lot going on, and it takes all of us kind of working together to solve problems, to make, the entire process more efficient, whether it's AI or just, better integrations and better communication between counterparties, right? It's not one company or one business, that takes the entire process from beginning to end. It takes us all working together to make the process more efficient and hopefully, pass those savings and efficiencies on to the, the homeowner.
Yeah. So collaboration, right? That was a huge component of this event, a huge highlight of it from start to finish. Right on. James Cahill, highlight of the evening.
I kind of piggyback that too. I've been talking to clients for 5-6 years now, and it's nice to do it over Zoom. It's lovely to see everyone's face, but when you actually get to shake a hand, meet someone, hang out with them, it really is a different relationship. And it's funny that, there's so many different pieces that you know about, whether it's banks, credit union, servicing, but when you get to mix them all together and hear them talk and kind of, you're this side of the mortgage industry and like put it all together and you also get to do it with them. It really is it's a great experience.
Hear, hear. Absolutely. Yeah. In person, collaborating, learning stuff. That's a good note to end on, James. Appreciate you giving insights in general at the event, but also this would be, I believe, your first forum. So thanks for hosting that session with KJ as well. It was a super informative. Yeah, let's end it there. Thanks, you three. Good discussion. And we'll talk again soon.
Thank you much.
Thanks, guys.
Whew. All right. That was a good one. A lot of really good content today. Big thanks to Alex, Jeff, Vimy, James. Great discussion. Great insights. Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for being here. That's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning into Optimal Insights.
Is your technology vendor selling real solutions or just the idea of them? Too often, companies pitch big returns, offer free trials, and promise seamless automation, only to reveal during implementation that the tech doesn't actually exist. At Optimal Blue, we take a different approach. Our AI-powered automation is already live, already delivering, and already saving lenders real dollars. We show you exactly where the ROI comes from and how it reduces risk. No vague timelines, just proven technology that's working in production today. AI at Optimal Blue isn't just about delivering software. It's about empowering lenders to make smarter decisions, operate more efficiently, and stay ahead of the curve. Built around real capital markets challenges, informed by direct engagement with thousands of clients, and focused on delivering measurable value at no additional cost to clients. While others talk about AI, we're delivering it. Innovation that delivers for your bottom line. Learn more at optimalblue.com.